Support for WYPR comes from University of Maryland Medical System, committed to advancing the health of Maryland through academic medicine. With locations across the state, care is delivered close to home. Learn more at ummms.org.
Good afternoon. Thanks for being with us. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. The war with Iran continues to spread horrible violence, chaos, and uncertainty across the Middle East and around the world. Gas prices have spiked across the globe. In Europe, they're up 70%. In a press conference at the Pentagon this morning, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth acknowledged that Iran's missile and drone capabilities, while attenuated, are still a threat.
Just 1 month in, only 1 month, we set the terms. The upcoming days will be decisive. Iran knows that, and there's almost nothing they can militarily do about it. Yes, they will still shoot some missiles, but we will shoot them down. Of note, the last 24 hours saw the lowest number of enemy missiles and drones fired by Iran. They will go underground, but we will find them.
A Kuwaiti oil tanker was set on fire off the coast of Dubai yesterday. The Strait of Hormuz remains almost completely closed. Israel has continued its offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. The Houthis in Yemen have fired missiles towards Israel, and they've threatened access to the Red Sea. We begin today with Aaron David Miller. He's a former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator and a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Aaron, welcome back. Always good to have you.
Tom, thanks for having me.
So the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, spoke this morning. I think he mentioned Israel one time. How do you see the current relationship between Israel and the United States in terms of this joint war effort? What does the current status of the war mean for the future of the Middle East and the future of Israeli U.S. relations?
Look, I think from a military standpoint, the last month, we're now in the fifth week of the war, has shown an extraordinary partnership between the Trump administration and the Netanyahu government. I can't think of a time, perhaps 2003, when the U.S. partnered with Britain in the second Iraq War. I can't think of a time when the United States identified and partnered and coordinated with an American ally as closely as Trump administration has coordinated with the Israelis. There are diverging goals, there is friction, but above all, this relationship is governed by one fundamental overriding priority. Benjamin Netanyahu needs to be reelected, wants to be reelected. 2026, the government will go to term in October. You might see elections before that. Donald Trump cannot elect him, but Netanyahu right now is extremely vulnerable to the political crosswinds in Israel. He needs Donald Trump as a aggressive campaigner. It could determine the margin between his re-election or not. Remember, he's on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in a Jerusalem district court before three judges. That trial's now ongoing 5 years. He faces either acquittal, conviction, or a plea agreement, which would probably mean the end of his career to avoid prison time. So the leverage here is really one way. Donald Trump has extraordinary leverage over Netanyahu, which is why when the president decides, if he does decide, that the war is over, he will call the prime minister, who will dutifully respond, thank you very much, yes, sir, the war is over.
And will the war be over in Lebanon as well? I mean, Israel and the United States do have very divergent geopolitical concerns here and goals here. I mean, and the Israeli public, as I understand it, is quite supportive of the offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon, particularly folks in northern Israel who've been displaced a couple times and are sick of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that Israel's security policy has been fundamentally reoriented in the wake of October 7. October 7 not only represented an intelligence failure, it represented an operational failure on the part of the Israeli Defense Forces, who within the first 48 hours could not, for reasons that will probably await a state commission of inquiry, if one should ever be permitted by the current government, unlikely, to try to figure out why Israeli security forces could not rescue the hundreds of Israeli civilians who were killed by Hamas, some taken hostage, sexual predation, mutilation. All of these horrible things has reoriented the Israeli security policy. And you see it everywhere. It's not just preemption and prevention. It's an aggressive Israeli policy to operate in the territory of their adversaries. You see it in Gaza. Gaza is now divided into two. Hamas controls 47%. The Israelis control the balance. You see it in Lebanon, where the new Israeli strategy is to make large parts of southern Lebanon uninhabitable. Certainly a no-go zone for Hezbollah, but more seriously from the standpoint of Lebanese civilians and the Lebanese government, probably makes the return of hundreds of thousands of Lebanese civilians impossible. If the Trump administration has a problem with this, they certainly haven't demonstrated it, nor have they demonstrated any tough response to what could only be described as a war of terror waged by Israeli settlers, primarily young Israeli settlers, against Palestinians in the West Bank. So, yeah, there may be divergent goals. The U.S. may have additional other interests, but this administration is certainly not decided either to make the West Bank or Lebanon, or Gaza for that matter, an area in which they're prepared to constrain Israeli military and security activities.
Yesterday, I believe the Knesset, the right wing of the Knesset, passed a death penalty law for Palestinians convicted of terrorism. The last person executed in Israel was Adolf Eichmann, who was arrested in Argentina in 1960 and executed in 1962. When it comes to Prime Minister Netanyahu's reelection chances, what do you make of, you know, that development? That is a law that's, you know, unpopular, certainly with the Israeli left. But how do you see it? Do you see it affecting Netanyahu's standing, which evidently has, you know, improved since the offensive in Lebanon?
Well, the recent polling, I guess last week, shows that Netanyahu, that Likud, if elections were held today, Likud would not have picked up a single seat as a consequence of what is now a war with Iran that began 5 weeks ago on February 28th. And the opposition, neither can the opposition. In the Israeli political system, you need 60 plus one in 120-seat parliament, Israeli Knesset, to govern. The polls suggest that neither the opposition, the anti-Netanyahu bloc, nor the right-wing bloc of the current prime minister, with the Likud as the largest party, would not be able to form a government. So clearly, the Iran war has not boosted Benjamin Netanyahu's political prospects. Whether or not the election will go to the government will go to term in October, the average length of an Israeli government since independence is 1.2 years. This government was formed in December of 2022. It's had quite a run, particularly as this prime minister has presided over a failed judicial reform process, which is still, unfortunately for Israeli democracy, alive and well, but failing in terms of the complete undermining of the Supreme Court, which is critically important in the Israeli political system as a balance and a check against executive power. And of course, the largest intelligence and operational failure in Israel's history on October 7. So it's unclear. It may well be that we could be on the cusp of seeing what we saw between 2020 and 2022, which was four elections in 5 years, with Benjamin Netanyahu having a blocking majority, which prevents the formation of any government without Benjamin Netanyahu as the prime minister. So more uncertainty in Israeli politics, why this should be of any surprise, given the uncertainties in this region, shouldn't come as a shock to anybody.
If you've just joined us, it's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today, Aaron David Miller. He is a former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator, and he's now a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So, Aaron, as a former negotiator, what do you make of the possibility of sending combat troops into Iran or other areas in the Middle East? The president has ordered tens of thousands of troops at this point to the area. It's certainly an option he appears to be considering. There were nuclear negotiations going on in the summer, and the United States, in the middle of those negotiations, decided to bomb the nuclear facility. They were renewed negotiations just a few weeks ago, a month or so ago, and they decided to bomb in the middle of those negotiations. As a matter of fact, Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, said, we negotiate with bombs. How does this ever get on track, given that
it may not.
Perspective?
There are no good options with respect to Iran. You have a brutal, repressive, authoritarian regime, which is now, or it was before February 28th, the nuclear weapons threshold state. That is to say, Iran had all of the elements required to actually produce a deliverable nuclear device, but apparently no political decision had been made in order to move toward that goal. There are no transformational endings here with Iran. They're only transactions. And the transactions occur over the years, either with quiet understandings that have minimized and reduced conflict, or, as we saw in 2015, the Obama administration reaching a nuclear agreement with Iran, which was flawed but functional. It put distance in between Iran's capacity to actually produce a weapon and where the Iranians are now. As we know, in 2018, the Trump administration unilaterally walked out of that agreement, which accelerated Iran's nuclear program and created a sense that the Iranians were not, as the president has said, which he used as one justification for the war, that the Iranians were within weeks of producing enough fissile material to make a bomb. That's not true. But the Iranians have 6,900 pounds, roughly 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium at 60%, buried somewhere. There have been all, and that is a foundation for, again, resuming enrichment at some point. This war will be considered a strategic failure for the U.S. if it stopped tomorrow. And it was a war of choice. Let's be very clear. There was no reason, no imminent or critical threat. To quote Oliver Wendell Holmes as the Supreme Court justice on a domestic matter way back in the day, there was no clear and present danger here. The president decided to take the country to war for any number of reasons. The war of choice, though, has sort of evolved and morphed into what some people now argue is a war of necessity. Because if the straits remain closed, they're actually not closed. The Iranians control who gets in and who gets out. And the Iranians are making an enormous amount of money exporting their own oil.
Yeah, they use the Straits of Hormuz themselves. Right. So sure, of course.
And the big winners here are Russia, for sure, for any number of reasons. But if this war concludes with the regime in place, in fact, it's a much harder line regime. I think what you're going to see in Iran is a figurehead from the clerical establishment, maybe, but with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps running the country. If the regime survives and the straits remain in Iranian preferential control, this will be, by any standard, a major strategic disaster and defeat for the United States. That said, tomorrow, if Donald Trump decided to give a speech and basically to say, we won, there would not be a single constituency in this country that he cares about that would do anything other than breathe a giant collective sigh of relief. And if he did that, however, the Iranians would have to cooperate. They'd have to stand down too. And there's no guarantee if Trump made such a speech and directed that all military activity against Iran will end, there's no guarantee the Iranians would cooperate.
Yeah, and certainly no guarantee they'd open the strait. That seems to be their biggest card in their hand. The president, Secretary of Defense, are saying that the regime has changed, that we've achieved regime change in Iran. You buy that argument?
Well, it has changed. There's no doubt about it.
But has it changed at all in favor of the – is there any indication that the change is somehow favoring the United States and Israel?
No.
Yeah.
If 10 months from now, assuming the war is concluded by then, if a process was set into motion that the regime fractured somehow because it couldn't meet – look, Iran was in terrible economic shape before this war began. The amount of destruction that the Israelis and the Americans have wrought, not just on Iran's military facilities, its drone production, its ballistic missile inventory, but on civilian infrastructure. Whoever rules Iran in the wake of this war is going to be burdened with an extraordinary amount of destruction. I wouldn't rule out changes, significant changes, as the months go on. But no, if Hegseth and the president say we've gotten regime change because now we have an Iranian Delcy Rodriguez who was willing to negotiate with us.
Who's the new president of Venezuela. Right.
Right. My colleague at Carnegie, Karim Sejapour, says Trump was looking for an Iranian Delcy Rodriguez, but what he got was an Iranian Kim Jong-un, and not just one Kim Jong-un. And that's part of the problem, because I don't know who's making decisions in Iran. The killing of Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, may well be the most transformative event to date, because he has ruled Iran since 1989, since the death of the Ayatollah Khamenei. He, more than any other Iranian cleric or guard member, has been responsible for bankrupting the country, for pursuing its proxy wars, for trying to gain influence in at least four Arab capitals, and becoming a global sponsor of terror. So his passing will, in fact, change the country. How it's going to change the country it remains to be determined. And frankly, by the looks of who's in charge now, it's not a good change.
We have a listener, Stacy, who asks, the government of Israel's talk of using the Gaza model in Lebanon seems to be further evidence that disproportionate use of force, deliberate targeting of civilians, and arbitrary blocking humanitarian aid is not an accident, but Israel's intent. And she says it's a clear violation of Israel's obligations under international humanitarian law. There are reports that yesterday Israel and the United States bombed an orphanage in Iran. What do you see as the relationship between the military action in Lebanon, the military action in Gaza? Palestinian officials report about 680 deaths since the ceasefire in Gaza, the criticisms that Israel was subject to prior to the ending of the hostilities, the putative ending of hostilities in Gaza, you know, remain. What is the Lebanese action? How does it inform our understanding of that?
As I mentioned, I think the Israeli security policy in the wake of October 7, has been altered from preemption and prevention to operating in the territory of their adversaries. And I think military power is an instrument to achieve practical and feasible and realistic goals. I don't think that occurred in Gaza. A year into this war, the war could have ended. Or put it this way, in the hands of another Israeli prime minister, a Rabin or a Peres or an Ehud Barak, even an Ariel Sharon, who was the architect of the settlement movement, but in 2005, basically dismantled the settlements in Gaza and forced 8,000 Israeli settlers out. In the hands of an Israeli prime minister who understood the relationship between military power and realistic and feasible political goals, and who wasn't on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, I think many, many, many Palestinian lives would have been spared. Because the war served, sadly and tragically, Mr. Netanyahu's interests. That said, the context of that war needs to be kept in mind. Do I think Israelis committed war crimes in Gaza? That's for the international lawyers to decide. I would say common sense, yes. And I also think on October 7, Hamas committed war crimes as well. So I think the context here is important. But bottom line, after 3 years, Hamas survives as the most preeminent decision maker in Gaza, governing by co-optation and intimidation. In Hezbollah, the Israelis believed in the fall of 2024, they had hollowed out Hezbollah's military capacity. And yet, Hezbollah retains anywhere from 20 to 25,000 short and medium range ballistic missiles and rockets, and is daily still rocketing northern Israel. So, I think the question here is not whether Gaza applies to Lebanon. The question is whether what the Israelis have done in Gaza and Lebanon are cautionary tales with respect to what the U.S. and the Israelis believe they can accomplish in Iran. Unless the regime changes, Tom, in a meaningful way that normal humans would regard as an improvement in what we've seen, this will have been a strategic defeat.
And in a piece you and Daniel Kurtzer wrote in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, you quoted a satirist named Ambrose Bierce, who defined peace as a period of cheating between two periods of fighting.
And we can only... a satirist to be sure. Look, I just turned 77. I'm not prepared to mortgage my own kids and my own grandkids' future, let alone the future of generations of Israelis and Palestinians, by saying that Ambrose was right. I quote Jack Kennedy, the last president who had ever had an emotional impact on me. I was 12 when he was murdered. Kennedy described himself as an idealist without illusion. That's where I am. Never giving up on the prospect that you can be changed for the better, your family, your city, your nation, the world can be changed for the better. But as you go through the process of trying to do that, you really need to go through it with your eyes wide open. Anyone whose actions are tethered only to the way they want the world to be, rather than partly to the way the world really is going to fail every time. So,
yeah, indeed.
Hope and hard work, Tom.
Yep.
Hope and hard work.
Aaron David Miller. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you, Aaron. I appreciate it, and happy Passover.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay.
You
and up next, after a short break, I'm joined by a film and podcast producer and creator, Sharon Mashihi. She's the daughter of Iranian Jewish immigrants to the United States. We'll speak with her after a break. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.